offence. But of course, when we look at what has occurred since the 7th of October, what we have to consider are a number of different principles, such as principles of proportionality, principle of distinction, where you are distinguishing between civilian and military targets. So, you know, it's not just, yes, it has the right of self-defense and it can effectively do whatever it sees fit. That's not what international law says. And when I hear British politicians, for example, saying that the actions post 7th of October are consistent with international humanitarian law, are consistent with the right of self-defense, one has to ask the question as to whether these politicians have actually ever read anything that relates to international humanitarian law. Because to say that the actions taken thus far are in accordance with international law is just wrong. I can see that that position is gradually changing, particularly when we're talking about the targeting of hospitals and the most recent targeting of the hospital. But of course, the action that you take, even if you accept that there is a right of self-defense, what we're actually seeing is a decimation of Gaza. We're seeing the flattening of civilian structures on residential homes. And that's, as we've seen leading up to October 7th, even long before that, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, this collective punishment, this literally demolition of people's homes. I mean, that can never be justified.
Before we get into these details, I want to ask you, Toby Cadman, about this supposed right that I gather members of a population, an occupied people, the people living under subjugation or oppression, the right of armed elements of those peoples to engage in armed resistance against their oppressors or against their occupiers. So I want to ask you this question. If on October 7th, if Hamas militants had dashed across that barrier and only targeted soldiers, if they had not targeted civilians, if they had just targeted soldiers, would that have been permitted under the laws of war?
Well, as with the question of self-defense, as far as Israel is concerned, obviously Palestine has a right to defend itself as well. It's not a stretch to suggest that what the Palestinian people have been subjected to is a system of apartheid. The difficulty that you have is that we're not dealing with a regular military. We're dealing with a group of fighters that have formed into an entity which is designated as a terrorist entity in a number of different states. So whilst you can say that any military targets could be argued as being a part of a legitimate military campaign, you have to look carefully at each situation and each incident to see whether under international law or even under national law as to whether that is justified.
Let's talk about hospitals, targeting ambulances, targeting workers with the Red Crescent and other healthcare workers. Israel says and has actually said, just yesterday there was apparently, or the last day, there was a post to the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, posted on Twitter, which was subsequently deleted, stating that hospitals and ambulances in these places are legitimate targets because Hamas is hiding in them. And that ambulance we hit was carrying Hamas workers, and Hamas is using Al-Shifa Hospital as their command and control center. Assuming that were true, assuming that Hamas's command and control center was or is under Al-Shifa Hospital, would Al-Shifa Hospital be a legitimate target? And likewise with an ambulance, if it were actually the case that Hamas militants were hiding inside of an ambulance, would the IDF be in their rights to attack that ambulance?
Well, I think the answer to that question has really been effectively answered in the context of the attack on the refugee center, when the IDF had said that there was a senior Hamas commander there, and that's why they had targeted that particular center. The response very quickly from the UN and from a number of different sources, was that the fact that there might be a commander there is no justification for targeting what is a civilian protection area. So I suppose in answer to your question, no, it's not justified. It's very similar to what we saw in Sarajevo in the early 90s, when a number of ambulances as part of a convoy was targeted. The Bosnian army had been given safe passage to move out of a particular area, and the Serb military targeted that convoy, which included ambulances marked very clearly Red Cross. And so the suggestion was that they were trying to move weapons from one area to another, and so it was justified as a military target. And that wasn't accepted. It wasn't accepted because they couldn't establish that it was being moved exclusively or predominantly for that purpose.
It wasn't accepted by which court?
By the ICTY. I myself was working at the Bosnian Prosecutor's Office at that time, and that was one of the cases we had investigated for the purposes of bringing a prosecution. I mean, ultimately, the prosecution didn't go forward, but it wasn't on the basis that these were legitimate military targets. It was concluded that they were not legitimate military targets. I mean, you have to be incredibly careful when you're making the argument that because there is an element of militancy within what is a civilian area, it doesn't give them the justification to annihilate, destroy that facility where you've got several hundred civilians who are at risk. I mean, we've all seen from yesterday the tragic footage of babies now being laid out and effectively dying because there is no incubation for them because the hospital has effectively been brought to halt. I mean, that can never be justified.
And yet the Western powers almost unanimously state that, you know, Israel has the right to defend itself, and of course it must protect civilians, but the situation that it's in, and it must abide by international law in doing so, but it's the situation it faces is very difficult because Hamas fighters are hiding within the population and using the population as human shields. Whatever position you take on that assertion...
Sure. Well, let's look at the similar situation when the Sri Lankan army had targeted the Tamil Tigers, when there was a military campaign because the argument was being made that the Tamil Tigers, a group of militants, were hiding amongst the civilian population. So then it was justified. Did the international community support that military attack? No, of course they didn't. They condemned those attacks. By the same token, what we see in Syria with Russians targeting hospitals in Idlib and Aleppo, do we accept that as justified? Even though the argument is being made that there are militants hiding out in those hospitals, no, we don't accept that. I think what we are talking about now, and certainly the language which is coming out from Western leaders, certainly in the last 24 hours, I think is starting to shift. There was complete support for all of the action being taken by Israel up until now. I think the scenes that we're seeing in the last 24 hours, and even statements coming out from the Biden administration, is being very, very critical of that campaign targeting that hospital. It's regrettable that it's taken more than 11,000 deaths and the targeting of two hospitals in a refugee camp before we get to that point. But at least we are getting to that point. And I'm not wishing to be overly controversial, but I think I made the point when I was asked the question before, is that if we were talking about anywhere else in the world, we wouldn't even be having this discussion.
And of course, Israel says it's not targeting civilians. We categorically deny that we're targeting civilians. And yet something like approaching 12,000 people have died, Gazans, 25,000 injured, some, I don't know, 4,500 or 5,000 children and small children, infants killed. And so by definition, it's clearly not discriminating between armed militants and civilians.
Well, no, because that all boils down to what do they consider a civilian to be, and how do you designate a civilian? I mean, when you look at some of the language which has been used by leading Israeli officials, the very, very troubling language which has been used, you know, referring to them as animals, I mean, really does demonstrate that level of intent. The other thing that I would say is that we quite often hear that the IDF is the most moral army in the world. And what they do is they make announcements so people can leave. But I suppose one of the responses to that is when you're giving people advance notice that you're going to target an area and they decide not to leave or they cannot leave, and then you target them and countless civilian lives are lost, can the IDF then rely on the fact that they had, well, you know, we warned them, we told them to leave? And I think a number of different international scholars have come out in the last few days saying that does not give you a blanket defense. You cannot tell people to leave and then target what is a civilian area. There still has to be a military necessity to that attack. And right now, we only have to look at the pictures of what Gaza once was and what it is now. And you can see the level of bombardment. You know, when we start to look at the numbers of attacks, the numbers of civilian neighborhoods that have been destroyed, I mean, you have to take all of that into account to determine what is the military necessity of this current action.
What is perfidy? And is Israel guilty of perfidious acts?
So if you provide safe passage, I had used the phrase when I was interviewed previously, I think it was on Al Jazeera, when I was asked about the attacks in the south, when effectively the warning had been given that the northern part of Gaza would be attacked, because that's where it was considered the concentration of Hamas fighters were. So civilians were told to move to the south, which they did in very large numbers. Those that could did. And then those, as they were moving, were then targeted by Israeli forces, or certainly the suggestion is that they were targeted by Israeli forces. So when you look at the crime of perfidy, it is that you provide safe passage and then you target deliberately those that you've given safe passage to. So going back to the Bosnia example, we had one investigation where safe passage was given to exit a certain area, and then that convoy was targeted by Serb forces. That fell within the crime of perfidy, because you're effectively, what you're saying, it's perfidious to attack when you've given safe passage.
And is that a war crime, or is that a crime against humanity?
It's a war crime.
Is Israel committing genocide, or do Israel's activities and actions appear to you to be genocidal? And there's a distinction between the crime of genocide and genocidal acts.
Yeah, so obviously there is a distinction between the two terms. And I think one of the things that we have to look very carefully at is the language in particular which is used. I mentioned before the term animals was being used. And I think the term animals is being used in very much the same way as cockroaches was being used in the context of the Rwandan genocide. I think that there are certainly statements that are being used, actions that are being taken that have the hallmark or the hallmarks of the intent to commit genocide. Again, it's a long process to document and investigate a matter such as this. But the other thing that we have to think of is when we look at genocide, it's not just looking after the fact. There are obligations on the state as a signatory to the convention to prevent genocide. And certainly that falls on all states who are state parties to the convention. We currently have in the International Court of Justice a case which is focusing on the genocide against the Rohingya, for example. And so states are now deliberating at the ICJ on what other states' responsibilities are to prevent genocide. And as we know, genocide is not an easy charge to prove. We see in the context of Bosnia, it was only established as far as Srebrenica was concerned. And the ICJ didn't conclude that Serbia was responsible for a genocide. And then we had the case of Croatia and Serbia, where similar arguments were made. So it's not a straightforward process. But, you know, when you have statements such as we've seen from a number of different ministers, and particularly far-leaning right-wing ministers in the current administration, calling for the complete destruction, and actually not only are you forcing the people out, but you're also signaling an intent that you will be governing Gaza in the future. I mean, when you look at all of these statements that are being made, it is gradually making the case that we may be looking at genocide.
And there are, I don't know how many families in Gaza that have been annihilated completely. I don't know, 500 or 600 families where 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, you know, 15, 20 members of the family, the entire family, have been wiped out. And some of these just little babies, premature babies and infants, have been identified. They're still alive. And they've been identified as, we don't know who this little kid is. They've got no family left. I mean, this, whether or not, you know, Israeli leaders have declared that they're going to totally wipe out the Palestinian people, the people of Gaza, they're doing it here and there.
Well, no, I mean, the thing that you have to remember, as I'm sure you know, is that it's not about wiping out an entire people. It's, you know, when you look at the strict application of the Convention Against Torture, it's whether there is an intent to destroy in whole or in part. And what we have with genocide being somewhat different to establishing crimes against humanity, which require a widespread or systematic attack. When you look at genocide, you don't even have to fire a single bullet in order for it to amount to genocide.
You can just deny them all those things that they require in order to live. So you prevent food, water, electricity, fuel, medicine. And right now, I gather people are starving in Gaza.
Yeah.
And they've got nothing to drink. They're drinking polluted water.
That's right. That's right. And I mean, that in itself, I mean, the starvation is a war crime in and of itself. I mean, we've seen that raised in the context of the conflict in Yemen, in particular, through the Saudi-led coalition seeking to starve the opposing population. So that in and of itself constitutes a war crime.
Now, meanwhile, we've got events going on in the West Bank, which we've not spoken about. And there's all kinds of things happening in the West Bank. Raids in cities up and down, from Jenin down to Hebron and everywhere in between. And like 1,000 people arrested, a couple of hundred people or 250 Palestinians killed, which may or may not amount to unlawful killings. But what astonishes me the most is settler violence, which is expanding, and the settlers who are in and out of IDF uniforms. So there's soldiers in uniform and out of uniform collaborating with settlers who are in or out of uniform, and there's no distinguishing them. They're attacking Bedouins who are a protected people, and the Israeli military is solemnly bound to protect these people under the Fourth Geneva Convention and not to settle the territory with their own citizens, but they have, which is a war crime under the Rome Statute, and soldiers are actually collaborating with the settlers
and arming them. I mean, we've, you know, that's one of the things that we have seen is that, you know, civilian settlers are being armed. I mean, I think it was always the fear is that whilst the attention is on Gaza, everyone's looking away from the West Bank. And obviously, we're now seeing an escalation of attacks in the West Bank as well.
And this is profoundly unlawful under the Fourth Geneva Convention.
Absolutely. I mean, moving any population into an occupied area is unlawful under the Fourth Geneva Convention. I mean, it's very clear. I mean, we've been talking about this for years.
So, Toby Cadman, what do you think the International Criminal Court's going to do? Or to be more specific, what do you think Chief Prosecutor Karim Khan is going to do? What's going through his mind now? What are his calculations? What is the calculus that goes into launching a prosecution? And everybody's been asking, like, holy crow, it took between the time when Karim Khan announced that he was going to initiate his investigation in Ukraine and the time, the day when he announced that he was going to be prosecuting Putin. That was like 1 year, a single year. And the Palestine situation's been brewing since, I don't know, 2016, 2019. The tribunal, the court, the judges said yes, the ICC had jurisdiction. But it just seems to be going nowhere.
I mean, I think one of the challenges and the distinction that I would draw between the situation in Ukraine and the situation in Palestine is primarily one of access. So Ukraine has become one of the most documented conflicts in history. I mean, we've got literally hundreds and hundreds of groups on the ground investigating and documenting. So it is a very different situation when Israel refuses to allow investigators to come into the country to investigate. I mean, when Karim Khan finally went to visit, and he was, you know, he was not even allowed to enter into Gaza. He was restricted to the Rafah crossing.
And yet Michael Link, like former UN special rapporteur on the situation in Palestine, Michael Link has said, and I know others have as well, that there is no situation in the world today in modern history that has been as well documented as Israel's occupation, 55-year occupation of Palestine, that it's been thoroughly, comprehensively, exhaustively documented. So one wonders, what on earth is Karim Khan waiting for?
I mean, you also have to understand that there is a gulf of difference between human rights monitoring reports and criminal investigations. Obviously, I'm not necessarily defending action or inaction on the part of the ICC. I mean, we had, through the previous prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, I mean, she had announced and had put as, you know, one of her sort of completion strategies that the situation in Gaza and the West Bank, including Jerusalem, there was a whole host of crimes under investigation on both sides, both from what Hamas was doing attacking Israel and what Israel was doing in the occupied territory. So they were both on the radar and under investigation. I think when Ukraine happened, all resources were diverted, clearly diverted to Ukraine, and nothing up until the 7th of October, nobody at the ICC was necessarily looking particularly actively or at all at the situation in Palestine. That has obviously changed now. And of course, there is now a much stronger likelihood than ever before that there will be investigations, that there will be arrest warrants issued. And I would certainly hope that they are done fairly on both sides to represent the nature of the conflict. I can't speak for Karim Khan, and I can't speak for his office as to what he is doing or what he should be doing. I don't necessarily agree with the criticisms that he hasn't come out speaking publicly, because, you know, words are cheap. I mean, it's action that counts. I would much rather not hear a word from him and then see in 12 months unsealed arrest warrants for those accused of war crimes or crimes against humanity. I mean, that's what matters, is that there has to be action. His office cannot turn a blind eye to this. I mean, this has now become such a conflict, as we say, 11 rising, probably 12,000 now, and actually probably much higher than that, civilian deaths, somewhere between 12 and 1,400 deaths in Israel as well. I mean, that all has to be properly investigated. They have to have access to the territory in order to be able to properly investigate that. You know, it's not just a matter of saying Hamas is responsible for what happened on the 7th of October and Israel as a state is responsible subsequent to that, because we're talking about a criminal court that deals with individual criminal responsibility. It's not state responsibility, it's individuals. So they've got to ensure that they are targeting those that bear criminal responsibility for what we are seeing now. And they are going to be the highest military and civilian commanders. And there has to be the level of support and cooperation as we saw in Ukraine, because that shows when we have the desire to do something, what can be done. We can't just criticize this happened in Ukraine and no one's doing anything about this. Well, we've shown what can be done. And now we have to replicate that as far as this conflict is concerned. Because if we don't, as we know, and I've said this 100 times, if you do not deal with it now, the cycle of violence continues. And the level of hatred that we see being spouted every day on this will continue and will get worse.
Well, following up on that point, with that international support for a prosecution, principally from the Western powers, would that be a sine qua non for Karim Khan in order to prosecute a case? Put it the other way around, knowing that the international, the Western powers, it's hard to imagine them, you know, standing by and allowing the prosecutor to prosecute Benny Gantz and Yoav Gallant and Netanyahu. I can imagine it would bring the roof down on the ICC. Would Prosecutor Khan move forward, knowing that he'd very likely not receive the support from Western powers? I mean, would such support be required, really, in order to prosecute the case?
Knowing Karim Khan, as I do, he would proceed whether he has that support or not. He's not going to be bound by political restraints. He's not that type of prosecutor. But obviously, it makes the job a great deal more straightforward and easier to justify if you do have that support. Because the one thing that Karim Khan has to be conscious of, whilst he may not bow to political pressure, he has to have the financial resources to dedicate and to build a team to do this work. And so he is, to a certain extent, dependent upon the international community, which is primarily the West, because they are the, by and large, the largest donors to the International Criminal Court. Even the US, which is obviously not a state party, regrettably, but it is also one of the donors for the Ukraine investigation. So I don't think we're going to see a situation like we had under Trump, when you have sanctions being brought against the prosecutor and judges for launching an investigation. I don't see that happening. And unless and until Trump is re-elected, I can't see that position being taken by the United States. But obviously, what we are seeing from my government as well is, I would say, a lack of commitment to what should be an impartially and independently applied system of justice.
Toby Cadman is an international law specialist in international criminal and humanitarian and human rights law and co-founder of the Guernica Group. He's the joint head of chambers at Guernica 37 International Justice Chambers in the UK. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Are you interested in radio, community-based media? You can join CJSF 90.1. We're a volunteer-run community radio station, and we always have space for new volunteers to become programmers, review music, edit audio, and so much more. All the training is provided, and anyone can join. To volunteer, email our volunteer coordinator, Noel, at vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Again, that's vol_4_CJSF@sfu.ca. Or you can visit our website, cjsf.ca. It's CJSF 90.1, diverse, independent, and yours.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind. The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.